been volunteering for Reasons to Believe. I can count at least 2 decades.
Oh, I think that's about right.
You joined us when you were just past your teenage years.
Right, so, something like that.
Right, something like that. So it's been a pleasure to have you back with us.
It's been great and, to be here.
And you've got quite the resume. I'm just going to read a few of the things that you're famous for. Leslie Wickman received a master's degree in aeronautical and astronomical engineering. Aeronautical and astronautical engineering, and a PhD in human factors and biomechanics from Stanford University. She is an internationally respected research scientist, engineering consultant, author, and inspirational speaker. For more than a decade, she was an engineer for Lockheed Martin Missiles and Space, where she worked on NASA's Hubble Space Telescope and the International Space Station programs, receiving commendations from NASA for her contributions and being designated as Lockheed's corporate astronaut. Hence, you earned the nickname Rocket Girl.
Right.
Okay. And you've actually been up in some of those things. So, she has lectured around the world on satellite servicing, spaceflight physiology, astronaut training and operations, as well as various topics in astronomy, environmental stewardship, and the interface between science and theology. Some of her recent projects, climate change impacts on national security, we'll be dealing with that in other episodes, assessment of future human space flight missions and technologies, human factors problems for extreme environments, and fighter pilot proficiency training, sustainable agriculture, and water reclamation. And hey, I just saw this, fighter pilot proficiency training.
Yeah.
I got to ask you, what did you think of that recent movie?
I'm embarrassed to say that I haven't seen Top Gun
yet.
Not yet. It's on the top of my list.
It's on the top of your list. Okay.
I've been very busy lately.
Yeah, so. Well, I actually talked to a fighter pilot, and he said some parts were on target and some were... The G-forces were a little extreme in the movie, apparently.
Yeah. That's Hollywood for you,
That's
right?
That's Hollywood for you, yeah. They show these guys going through G-forces of 15.
Oh, my goodness.
Doesn't work out too well.
Yeah.
Well, I refer to you as a Renaissance woman because you're not just into science and engineering and technology. You're also into the arts. I mean, if you ever go to Las Vegas and see the Bellagio Fountain, you had a hand in that.
Yes. So, yeah, absolutely.
And when you were a little younger than you are now, you played professional football.
I did indeed.
So, all right. So, have I missed anything?
Yeah, probably a few things along
the
way.
A few other things, but really, Renaissance woman, I think, describes you really well.
Thank you.
So, well, you want to talk to us about, climate change and how we can respond to it in a wise way, so...
Yeah. I think for the most part, what I want to focus on in this segment is environmental stewardship and creation care. Really, I think so many audiences that I speak with are concerned about the environment, especially Christian audiences, as we well should be. And I've had a number of mentors over the years that have kind of increased my concern for the environment. And
it is a biblical imperative,
it
right?
It is, absolutely.
Yeah.
In
so
fact,
we're Christians.
That's right, exactly. It's a topic that's near and dear to my heart. And I grew up in the Pacific Northwest. My dad was a forester. And so we always lived in kind of remote areas where it rained a lot and the trees grew tall. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, I've had various experiences with mentors, including Cal DeWitt from Calvin College, mm-hmm. Randy Van Dratt, who was also at Calvin College.
I met both those gentlemen. So.
Have you? Yes. Yeah. And so I've read their work. I've had a chance to meet them in person and just, have a deeper understanding of our call by God to be stewards of His good creation. So this is something that I love talking about, and I think Christians across the country and probably around the world are really eager to learn more about what they can do to be good stewards. And so I think this is a really timely issue.
Mm-hmm.
So when I start talking about this topic of environmental stewardship, I'm taken back to Scripture first and foremost. And these are very familiar scriptures. Genesis 1:31, God mm-hmm. saw all that he had made, and it was very good, or it was as it should be, right?
Yes.
And then flashing forward into the New Testament, John 3:16, that says, "For God so loved the world." And as we know, that word "world" in the Greek was cosmos.
Right.
So referring to how God so loved the entire creation, everything that he'd created, mm-hmm. everything he created and called good. And so I feel like, you know, if we have this kind of as a model, you know, God calling his creation very good, then we ought to all the more respect it and care for it and pay heed to his call to be good stewards.
Well, I mean, even if you just back up one verse in Genesis chapter 1, he says, "I'm putting you in charge."
Exactly.
"Manage it for your benefit and the benefit of all other life."
Yes.
So it's not just us looking at
exactly.
ourselves. What can we do to benefit the rest of Earth's life?
Exactly, yeah. So it's a serious mandate for us, and it does reflect God's care for the entire creation, not just humans, but all of life, all of the entire universe, you know. So
what recommendations do you have for how we can do it better?
Well, I actually, like I said, have taken some inspiration from a variety of different people. This is another individual at Arizona State University, William Johnson, mm-hmm. who identifies a number of different environmental themes that are woven throughout Scripture. And so the first of those themes is creation, that's by God, where God called it good, as we just mentioned. Again, stewardship that we just talked about a bit, where God gives humans responsibility for that creation. Next is the provision of God for humankind through his creation, as in Genesis 1:29, God said, "I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food." The next theme is the pleasure of God in his creation that we see not only in John 3:16, where we read about his love for creation and sending Christ to redeem it, but also in Revelation 4, verse 11, that says, "Worthy, O Master, yes, our God, take the glory, the honor, the power. You created it all. It was created because you wanted it." And I love that, you know, God taking pleasure in what he's created. The next theme is praise. All of creation praises the Creator, as in Psalm 69:34, that says, "You heavens, praise him earth, also ocean and all things that swim in it." And then we've got the authority of God over his creation, the witness of nature to God's authority and provision, consequences to creation, including humans, for mankind's wickedness. We see that in Revelation. And the perspective that God is above all of his creation. So a number of these themes, I think, are really important for us to
I like this one.
Yeah, right. So I found this cartoon. We're going to have to describe it for our listening audience. But the header of the slide says, "Where your treasure is, there will your heart be also," from Matthew 6:21. And the cartoon basically says, the threat to which delicate balance will spur an era of energy conservation. On the left side, you see a picture of the Earth. Mm-hmm. And on the right side, you see a guy looking at his checking account balance and screaming because it's so low. So, but this might be, you know, true in some
right,
sense
right.
that as the price of fossil fuels go up these days, it will start to make people think more seriously about energy conservation. And you know, we should be obviously concerned because of our mandate from God to care for creation. But with the rising prices, people are being forced to think a little bit more about energy conservation.
Right.
And I know that this is a topic that you're very interested right. in as well. So. For me, one of the motivating themes or one of the motivating conversations is that our planet, it seems to be such a rare planet. So far as we know in the cosmos, certainly in the solar system, but, you know, might be throughout the entire galaxy or even through the universe. We don't know. We've certainly begun searching and looking at some of these exoplanets or right. other stars. But as far as we know, our planet is the only one like it. And it has all these unique characteristics, the abundant water in all three physical phases that's so important for a life-giving water cycle.
And you're saying we have to have ice, water vapor, and liquid. And
exactly.
You can't just have one.
Yeah. That's exactly right. For the purifying cycle, for storage of the water reserves in frozen ice. It all works together, right?
And I mean, the water's got to be fine-tuned in its quantity.
Exactly.
We've actually found two Earth-like planets that are water-rich, but they got 500 times as much water as the Earth.
Wow.
And with that much water, you get ice at the bottom of the water, which means there's no connection between the rock and the water.
Yeah.
So too much water is a problem.
Right.
And so we're seeing planets that are bone dry with no water at all are
exactly.
planets that are just way too abundant in water.
Well, and it also gets to the size of the planet. It has to be pretty darn close to what Earth's size is to give it the right gravity to hold onto water vapor at 18 grams per mole, but not methane and ammonia at 16
right.
and 17 grams
right.
per mole. So that's right. that's tuning on a fine line, right? So it has to be just the right size. And, you know, this idea of the fine tuning of the Earth, you know, is often called the Goldilocks principle, right?
Right.
It's not too big, not too small, just right, or not too much, not too little, just right. And we see
and
that
you've got
over
a few
and over
hundred
again.
Of those, so it's not just one
exactly.
or two.
Exactly. Exactly. So for me, the more I understand everything that, and we're still discovering more all the time, but the more I understand the things that we have discovered that speak to the uniqueness of the Earth and the improbability of getting all of these characteristics right in just one planet, seems so remote to happen just by random chance. And so the fact that we do have this place that is so perfectly situated and finely tuned to support life makes me all the more cognizant of God's command to take care of it.
Kind of like what you see in Genesis 2, where God prepared this beautiful garden and he told Adam, take care of it.
Exactly.
And he prepared this incredible planet. And he's basically saying, take care of it. It's the same
exactly.
principle.
Exactly. The exact same principle. And so, you know, we hear talk of, you know, going to Mars and, you know, creating another Earth there or terraforming Mars to be like Earth. And the reality is, you know, Mars isn't a big enough planet to hold on to the right kind of atmosphere that we need, right? So again, for me, the space exploration that we do and the understanding of the planet that we have all motivate me all the more to take care of this good place that God has created for us.
Very good.
Yeah. So, you know, and I think also, I think of Romans 1:20, that, you know, the truth about God that can be seen in what he's created, right? So the truth about God is displayed in his creation. And when I first read that passage, I thought, well, yeah, we can see God's greatness, his power, his might, his control, you know, in his creation. But the more that I've studied that and the more that I've studied these characteristics of the Earth that make it such a perfect place for us, I understand that it reflects more of his character than just his power and might. It also reflects his goodness and his love, because he didn't create some place where we can just barely survive. We're not just some biology experiment.
Yeah,
you know,
we thrive.
Exactly.
We don't just live.
We flourish and thrive in this amazing place. We have an abundance of what we need, and it's not like we're you know, struggling for every breath.
And there's beauty, I mean.
And there's beauty, exactly.
You know, Psalm 97, the heavens declare the righteousness of God.
Yeah.
So it's not just his power and his might.
Exactly, exactly. So I've come to appreciate God's character as revealed in his creation so much more as I've studied it, and all the more as you grow that relationship, and it's a loving relationship where you understand God's care and love for you, the more you want to obey his commands, and certainly taking care of the earth is an important one.
Okay, so what should we do?
Well, let's keep pressing on here,
okay,
shall we?
Yes.
So,
big questions.
Yeah, so we have some big questions, such as the big question of who owns the earth and its resources. You know, these are questions, as with all big questions, that thinking humans typically come across sometime in their life. And oftentimes, I think, encountering nature prompts these big questions, right? It's our reaction of awe and wonder at what God's created often prompts these big questions. And so who owns the earth and its resources is one, I think. What ought to be the role of humans on the earth, and how can humans live on the earth sustainably? I think these are all questions that we should be thinking about related to environmental stewardship and how we take care of our planet. And I love this passage from Ecclesiastes, chapter 1, verses 5 through 7. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. And I love this poetic description that actually is a really nice acknowledgement of all of the earth's systems, the air, the water, the land, and life upon it. You know, I mean, it's just beautiful to see how...
An incredible water cycle.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, you see Job 37 and 38 talking about multiple forms of liquid precipitation, frozen precipitation,
right,
how they're all delicately balanced.
Exactly.
And we need every single one of them,
yeah,
to have humans populating the planet.
Exactly, exactly. And it's so beautiful to see these things reflected in Scripture that we see corroborated in the natural world. You know, I love that synergy between the two books of God's revelation, you
right,
know, how he reveals himself both in Scripture as well as his creation. So there are a number of environmental challenges that we're aware of that are threats to the creation that God blessed and called good. And this is just a partial list, and these are, you know, some things that we need to be thinking about and talking about and asking the question of how can we respond. So the limited energy resources, water pollution, water resources, air pollution, climate change, deforestation, loss of biodiversity. And obviously we're not going to have time to go into the details on all of these, but it is a starting point for conversation. And, you know, I think one of the things that you're very interested in are the energy challenges. And so if we look at the present rate of energy consumption, all of the Earth's fossil fuel energy, much of it in the form of coal, will be consumed within about 250 to 270 years. And the U.S. oil production peaked 3 decades ago, probably actually more than that, maybe 35 years or so. And global oil production is expected to peak very soon, if it hasn't already. And the bottom line really is that fossil fuels aren't going to last forever, never mind the release of greenhouse gases,
sure,
and the impact on our environment and climate. So,
well, you're a lot younger than I am, but in the days of Lyndon B. Johnson, he talked about the affluent society.
Mm-hmm.
And really, we're dealing with an effluent society.
That's a good point. That's a really good point, actually. Yeah, so, you know, we need to be looking at sustainable energy sources. I know that you're going to be talking about some of those either later in this segment or in another segment soon. But things like solar and wind and geothermal, hydroelectric, possibly even nuclear technology, which is extremely efficient and unfortunately has gotten a bad rap through the years. But I think there's a lot of promise in some of these areas. But especially if current energy use continues or rates of consumption continue, we really need to be focusing on more sustainable long-term energy sources. And of course, there is a growing demand across the world for safe and clean water as populations grow, and also the greater awareness of waterborne diseases that are spread through the use of contaminated water and wash water. So 18% of the world's population has inadequate water, and 40% lack sanitation treatment to maintain even the most basic health standards. And in developing countries, 80% of sickness is directly attributable to water-related diseases that we in the West take for granted as being easily preventable. So water is one of the biggest issues that I see. And again, you know, our Earth is so finely tuned and such a beautiful provision of the right amount of water and the, you know, just all these different characteristics that we've mentioned before. But yeah, water's obviously a huge challenge worldwide.
Even where we are here in Southern California.
Yeah, and the drought that really the whole West Coast is going through, and I'm sure there are other places as well. I mean, you know, we hear and read about drought in other areas of the world. And, you know, yeah, it's a very, very difficult problem. So if we then move on to air issues, you know, we look at the Earth from space and we see this, you know, it's been called the thin blue line of Earth's atmosphere, which is, you know, small next to the planet itself, but it's absolutely essential for our existence and for our health. But the quantity of pollutants that we're, as you referred to, an effluent society and we're pumping into the atmosphere, it's now significant enough to cause real contamination, especially in some areas. It leads to air pollution as well as acid rain and
respiratory conditions.
Exactly. And this is kind of an interesting aside. You know, a number of years ago, I went to a conference on climate intervention possibilities. And one of the main things that was talked about was to replicate the effects of volcanoes in cooling the Earth and the ejection of sulfur dioxide that volcanoes do. And so one of the biggest, most widely promoted ideas to cool the planet was to take these jet plane loads full of sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere and on a regular basis inject sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere. And I'm thinking to myself, well, sulfur dioxide causes acid rain, you know, and respiratory distress in humans and animals and all these other effects. And I thought, really? That's the best you guys have thought of, you know? And it was just shocking to me, but it was looking at the effects of temperatures after significant volcano eruptions.
Well, I mean, they're even talking about putting rockets in space, which would create a shield between us and the sun.
Right.
But all these things, you got to worry. I mean, they're not reversible.
Well, yeah. And
what if you get it too cold?
And never mind, yeah, and never mind the amount of fossil fuel energy that has to be expended to launch
to
all this
there,
stuff.
Right? Yeah.
And I mean, with the idea with the sulfur dioxide, it was like, you know, somewhere on the order of like 10 jet loads per day into the stratosphere on an ongoing basis. And I'm like, there's got to be a better solution. And You know, we've talked about before how complex climate is and how difficult it is to make accurate predictions about the future and whatnot. And I mean, for me, I come back to our mandate from God to be good stewards and to do what we know. You know, why would it be a good thing to pollute the air? Well, it's obviously not. Why would it be a good thing to pollute?
Well, I think the thing you're addressing, Leslie, is unintended consequences.
Right.
They're thinking through, hey, this is going to block out some of the sunlight.
Yeah.
But what are the implications
exactly.
of doing that? What are the long-term implications?
Yeah, is the cure worse than the problem?
And do you have a rheostat? What if you put too much or too little? Do you
exactly.
have a way of controlling it?
Exactly.
And most of these suggestions, there's no control. There's no rheostat.
Yes, exactly.
So.
That's exactly right. And so I keep, like I say, coming back to our responsibility to do what we know to take good care. And, you know, I mean, some of these things are fairly basic. You know, let's do what we can not to pollute the air. Let's do what we can not to pollute the water. Let's do what we can to be careful consumers. Let's do what we can to reduce, reuse, recycle. You know, let's not be gluttonous consumers of anything. You know, let's follow Christ's example. Let's follow the commandments in Scripture and do what we know to be good stewards and be careful about the things that we don't understand the unintended consequences for. So, I mean, those are kind of the things that I come back to in this whole discussion. I have a whole bunch more slides that we could go through, but I kind of would like to have a little bit more of a back and
forth. Well, let's take a break first. Have you ever stopped to wonder who God is? Have you ever wondered the nature of his character? The Bible tells us that God is faithful, holy, and gracious, that he is, in fact, the very definition of love. But how can we know this for certain? Psalm 19 says, "The heavens declare the glory of God." But what do the heavens reveal about God's character? If you ever ask questions like this, we invite you to join us at our God Is Conference, where you'll explore how God has revealed himself through the work of what he's created and through his word. Our hope is that the conference will bring you to a deeper understanding of who God is. Visit reasons.org, God Is, to learn more. Well, Leslie, I got a few suggestions. Some of this comes out of my book, Weathering Climate Change. Mm-hmm. Other stuff that's actually new that's not in the book. And just appreciate your feedback. And if you got other suggestions, feel free to weigh in.
Great.
But this first slide here shows you the Sahara Desert. And look all over this slide. You can't see a single green thing. I mean, it's bone dry.
Right.
And this particular map actually shows you the extent of the Sahara Desert. It's actually bigger than the entire continent of Australia. And a few years ago, they actually measured the rate at which the Sahara Desert was growing. It was advancing south by 6 miles per year.
Wow.
And what was causing that advance was people living on the south edge of the Sahara Desert, desperate for cooking fuel. And so they were harvesting what little shrubs and grasses they could find and using it for cooking and heating fuel. And so one of the things I've been advocating is that, you know, you got within the green movement, let's ban the use of all fossil fuels. I'm saying, well, maybe there's a wiser way we can use fossil fuels rather than banning them outright. So one radical idea I suggested was, why don't we go to the peoples living on the south edge of the Sahara Desert and basically say, hey, we understand you need cooking fuel, you need heating when it's cold at night. How about if we give you all the kerosene you want for free on the condition you work with us to replant the Sahara Desert?
Wow.
And 2,000 years ago, the Sahara Desert was only 10% the size it is today.
Wow.
I mean, if you read Roman history, what we call the Sahara Desert was the breadbasket for Europe. That's where they grew all our grain.
Wow.
And, you know, the Israelis have shown us how we can replant a desert as kind of a step-by-step approach where you begin to plant plants far apart. It causes transpiration, which increases the rainfall. Then you can plant with greater density. And literally within a single generation, you can replant a desert.
Amazing.
Now, we're not going to take it back to zero, but we will be able to take it back to the way it was in the days of the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
Which now means what is the Sahara Desert will be covered with wheat fields.
Wow.
And that's going to provide an income for all the North African people. The wildlife will return, because the wildlife has basically left the Sahara Desert region, with the exception of a couple of scorpions.
Right. So,
but the whole point is all that new vegetation will soak up huge quantities of greenhouse gases, provides an income from those people.
Yeah.
So it's one example of how we could use the fossil fuels we have in a way that actually helps alleviate climate change, restore climate stability.
Yeah, what you're talking about reminds me very much of some of the deforestation that's taking place in South America, where the locals that need fuel or income or a variety of different things are essentially cutting down the rainforest.
Right.
And oftentimes they're using the wood from the rainforest just for charcoal, to sell the charcoal for some income, which just seems like such an inefficient use of that beautiful wood.
It is.
But similar problems, right? I mean, they're motivated because they need fuel, they need income.
Well, they're also looking for income, so
exactly.
They say, hey, if we cut down the forest and transform it into pasture land, we can raise beef cattle and we can make a lot of money.
Right, exactly. So
but that's another example of unintended consequences.
Right. Yeah.
The Amazon forest, this is actually a shot of the Amazon forest.
Beautiful.
The healthy part of the Amazon forest. And today it measures to be 5.5 million square kilometers. It's over half of Earth's rainforest.
Mm-hmm.
However, if we keep cutting down trees and turning into pasture land, number one, the Amazon soil is nutrient poor.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you do convert it to pasture land, you got maybe only a decade. After that, you can't raise beef cattle anymore. And actually, you can go through the Amazon and see places where they've cut down the trees, created pasture land. 10 years have gone by. Guess what? It's a desert.
Yeah.
One of the rainiest places in the world
has
been transformed in just one decade into these local deserts.
Yeah.
And this is what they mean by the tipping point.
Mm-hmm.
If you continue to cut down trees in the Amazon, you reach a point where the forest can no longer produce the rainfall that sustains itself.
Right.
Because trees transpire water.
Right, exactly.
And so that's where a lot of the rain
of
the Amazon comes from.
Yeah.
And in 1970, there was 4.1 million square kilometers. 2019, just 3.3, a 20% loss in literally just 50 years.
Yeah, and there again is a huge source of converting CO2 into O2.
Right.
You know, the Amazon and other rainforests have been called the lungs of the planet, so to speak. Obviously, the effect is the opposite.
And, you know, they're looking at pasture land and saying, hey, we can make money. And so one of the things I've been suggesting is let's show them a way where they can make even more money than this temporary thing of cutting down trees and making pasture land. And you grew up in the Pacific Northwest?
Yes, I did.
I did too.
Right.
And this is actually a photo I took.
Very familiar.
Very familiar. This was just 6 miles from the house that I was raised in Vancouver. I would cross the bridge to North Vancouver, and I loved this park.
Yeah.
But when you look at this shot, and this one as well, what you see is a lot of old, dead wood.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with letting big trees grow old and dying, when they die, they release greenhouse gases in the atmosphere.
Right.
And so like with the Amazon, the Pacific Northwest, in fact, I would even say this is true of our national parks.
Mm-hmm.
We need to let the lumbering companies come in and harvest these old big trees that are in danger of dying.
Yeah.
Number one, they make a lot of money on those big trees because, you know, you got this big, thick tree.
Yeah.
And if we can harvest it at the right time, this now becomes sequestered carbon in the form of houses and furniture.
Exactly, yeah.
But the key is you don't clear cut.
Right, exactly.
You selectively take out the most valuable trees, and not all of them,
because
there's wildlife that needs a few big old trees.
Right.
So you select out some, then replace them by planting young trees.
Yeah.
And it's well established in the scientific literature that these young trees will grow up to four times faster than the big old trees, which means they're pulling four times as much greenhouse gas into the atmosphere. And it's easy to achieve a doubling factor, where you've got a wide spectrum of trees of different ages. And I think the tourists in our national parks would like it, because I don't know about you, I've been to some of the U.S. national parks, and a third of the trees are dead.
Yeah, no, you're right. And I think I mentioned my dad was a forester.
Right.
And preached for a very long time about good forest management. And this is exactly the type of thing.
Don't clear cut.
Exactly.
Take out the valuable trees.
Exactly.
Replant with young, fast-growing trees.
Yeah.
And don't make the trees too dense.
Yeah,
if they're too dense, the bark beetles will come in and kill all the trees.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if you take good forest management, number one, tourists love seeing green forests.
Yes.
They don't like seeing dead forests.
Exactly, or clear-cut areas.
Or clear-cut areas. And the wildlife loves it.
Yeah.
So the wildlife benefits, the tourists benefit, the lumber companies make mm-hmm. money, and you're pulling way more greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere.
Yeah.
Now, I would recommend to the lumbering companies, go in the wintertime when the tourists aren't there.
Right.
So.
Good point. That's really, really good stuff.
And you talked about fossil fuels. I mean, you mentioned coal. And coal produces these sulfur aerosols.
Yeah.
It produces black carbon soot.
Yeah.
And basically, it releases carbon dioxide.
Yeah.
One fossil fuel, methane, what we call natural gas,
mm-hmm.
when you burn it, you're making carbon dioxide and water.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, water is a greenhouse gas, but if you got too much in the atmosphere, it falls as rain and snow.
Right.
So no matter how much water you put in the atmosphere, it's going to stabilize.
Right, yeah.
So, burning fossil fuels to produce water is not an issue. Burning fossil fuels to produce carbon dioxide is an issue.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if we were to take all the coal out of energy consumption and mm-hmm. replace it with natural gas, number one, the natural gas is cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
It's cheaper than the coal. It's easier to transport.
Mm-hmm.
We got a lot more natural gas than we got coal. You mentioned we will run out of coal if we keep depending on it. But there's huge stores of natural gas mm-hmm. in the Earth's crust. And if you replace coal with natural gas, you get an immediate 50% reduction in greenhouse gases.
Awesome, yeah.
I mean, people have been talking about wind and solar mm-hmm. and nuclear. You can't get a 50% reduction without waiting a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than banning all fossil fuels, say, let's get rid of coal,
mm-hmm.
replace it with natural gas. We get an immediate 50% drop
mm-hmm.
in the greenhouse gases.
Yeah.
And we get no black carbon soot.
Right.
We get no aerosols. People in New Delhi won't be choking all the time from the air pollution.
Yeah.
And moreover, places like Canada and Siberia would really benefit.
Yes.
Because climate models tell us all that coal burning black carbon soot
changes the.
It doesn't get dumped on China and India.
Yeah.
It gets dumped on Canada and Siberia.
Yeah. And it the changing the ice pack from white to black
means it
increases
more
the solar radiation.
It does.
Yeah.
And Canada, for example, especially northern Canada, it's warming up five times faster than the rest of the world.
And
it's not carbon dioxide that's doing it. It's that black carbon
Exactly. Site. In fact, that's really the area that I've focused on, and we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves the program that we're going to be doing on national security.
On the strategic studies,
exactly. And so my focus has been on the Arctic, really, because mm-hmm. of the rapidity of losing ice, the opening of new sea lanes in that area, and one of the big things is the amount of carbon soot that's falling on the ice that changes the color from white to black and therefore absorbs more solar radiation. And it's a vicious cycle with, increasing the rate of the melting of the ice. And so that's a
If you've got more ships passing through there,
you're going to have even
exacerbates
more.
Exacerbates the problem.
That's exactly right, yeah. So we'll save some of the other
national security stuff.
But
let me throw this one out at you, too, because I'm looking at replacing coal with natural gas. You get an immediate reduction of 50%. What's it going to take to get it down to zero? Because I think that's the ultimate goal everybody has.
Mm-hmm.
But getting an immediate 50% payoff, I mean, nothing else we have delivers that kind of bang for a buck that quickly.
Yeah, no, that's very significant.
It's very significant. And if we go to natural gas, replacing all coal, that could buy us a time.
Yes.
To find something that really doesn't depend on fossil fuels.
Yeah. Yeah.
And one thing I've been attracted to is thorium nuclear reactors.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a thorium nuclear reactor that was constructed in 1960 on the Hudson River.
Oh.
And it works. It produced energy. It was never exploited, however. Everybody lost interest in it because you can't use it to make nuclear weapons.
Oh, interesting.
But today that's considered
right.
a plus.
Exactly.
That we could actually have all these nuclear reactors
right.
that you can't make weapons out of.
Yeah.
Which means you don't have to worry about some terrorists or
right.
rogue nation.
Getting hold of the fuel, yeah.
And so that's the Indian Point Energy Center in New York, built in 1962. So, and there was actually two of these built, but it was never scaled up.
Hmm.
Now, what's interesting about thorium, it's three times as abundant in the crust
wow.
of the Earth as uranium. And one ton gives you the energy equivalent of 200 tons of uranium.
Yeah,
so it's 200 times more efficient than
efficient.
Uranium. Or it's the equivalent of 3.5 million tons of coal.
Right.
So a little bit of thorium, you get a lot of energy.
And that's, I mean, across the board with nuclear, but I was not aware of the abundance of thorium. That's very interesting.
It's hugely abundant. The U.S. has enough to produce 100% of our total power needs for over 1,000 years.
Wow.
You know, people are concerned about nuclear because they're thinking about the radioactive waste.
Right.
What's interesting about thorium, you get 1,000 times less radioactive
Is
waste.
Is that right?
It's completely safe to handle after 200 years, and I think there's technology that could actually make it safe after 50 years.
Wow. So it has a shorter half-life then?
Well, it's a breeder reactor we're talking about.
Okay,
you're
gotcha.
Using the thorium-232
okay.
to make uranium-233.
Okay, gotcha.
But uranium-233 has a short half-life.
Okay.
So it produces a lot of heat, and then it's gone.
Okay.
But that's an advantage. To have it gone quickly, that's why you get 1,000 times
absolutely.
Less radioactive waste.
Wow.
Unlike uranium, where you got to store it for 50,000 years.
Right, exactly.
Which is a bit of a logistical
exactly,
nightmare.
Exactly, right?
When, here we're looking at something that's realistic, 50 to 200 years.
Right. And what about is thorium being used in any of the European plants?
Thorium is not being used for energy generation right now
okay.
anywhere in the world.
Okay.
But there are five nations that are seriously considering it.
Great.
Australia, India, Canada, Israel and the United States.
Great.
But I'm suggesting they need to be a lot more serious
yeah.
about this and gear up. And part of it, I think, is we need to educate the public.
Absolutely.
This is not like uranium.
Right.
It's a completely different animal. And so, for example, it's safer and more efficient to mine. You can take it right off the top of the earth. So you can strip mine it, which is cheap. And the people mining it don't have to wear special suits. The other big advantage is it's actually impossible to have a meltdown at a thorium reactor.
Wow.
No meltdown can happen.
See, because I think a lot of people react to the problems that have occurred at Three Mile Island,
Chernobyl,
et cetera,
right?
And so if there's not as big a risk for meltdown, then that should
there's
be
There's actually
huge.
A zero risk for meltdown and a zero possibility. Well, it's not actually zero. You can make nuclear weapons with thorium nuclear reactors, but everybody involved will die. So that pretty well stops people from trying.
Should be a demotivator.
That's a demotivator. That's why they say practically it's impossible
right.
to use it to make weapons. And you don't have to have special gear for the power plant workers.
Wow.
They don't have to be tested all the time. And I'm convinced that within 10 years, we could have enough thorium nuclear reactors in the world to basically say we don't need fossil fuels, we don't even need water power. This potentially could deliver electricity for less than half the price of water power, which today ranks as the cheapest source of energy.
Well,
so you wouldn't have to put dams on rivers anymore.
And I think that, you know, like you said, the public needs to be educated not only on safety issues, but also just the incredible efficiency of nuclear. You know, it's the whole E equals MC squared, right? It's this huge amount of energy that you get from a very tiny amount of mass.
Well, I think the engineering here is a big advantage. I mean, I remember when I was a student in physics, they were saying, hey, we're learning so much about plasma physics, we're going to have controlled nuclear fusion by the end of the century. Well, I mean, here we are 22 years exactly. after this, and we're no farther along than we were back in the 1960s.
That's exactly right.
So making a magnetic bottle that can stabilize a fusion reaction is not an easy thing.
No, absolutely not.
In fact, if you look at the sun, it's not magnetic. It's all gravity.
Right,
so,
exactly.
We got something as big as the sun, maybe. But
yeah.
But here's something that we know works.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
And the real challenge now is, and I think this is what's happening in the five nations that are involved in this, is the best way to make millions of thorium nuclear reactors that are small, or are we better off making a few really big thorium nuclear. Uh-huh. Where is the cost break the best?
Right.
You know, we could mass produce a bunch of small ones or make some big ones.
Right.
That's the unsolved problem.
Okay.
That's why I'm saying a decade, we should be there.
Yeah.
And so natural gas can buy us that decade with an immediate, drop in greenhouse gases. And matter of fact, the water we release could be a real help too.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Yeah.
And then, gear up for thorium, and now we all produce energy at a ridiculously low price.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Everybody's going to love it, and moreover, the electricity will be stable.
Yeah.
It's not like solar where, hey, if the sun's not shining or it's pouring rain, we've got a problem.
Yes.
We know this thorium will keep going.
Yeah, and bringing up solar and some of the other quote-unquote green sources of energy or sustainable sources of energy are all fraught with their environmental issues. I mean,
they are.
We've talked in Southern California about these big solar farms, and of course there are all kinds of concerns about disrupting habitats, and similarly for wind
power. You're not going to grow stuff underneath the panels.
Right, and also a big thing in Southern California is the disruption of the habitat of the desert tortoise as well.
Right,
and so with nuclear, again, the efficiency coupled with the safety that you gain with thorium.
And you don't need a lot of land
to
make these reactors. It's not like solar and wind where you're basically taking out
huge acreage.
Huge acreage, right.
Yeah.
I mean, I even saw that in Hawaii where they had this incredibly rich farmland and they covered it with solar panels.
Wow.
And so nothing's growing there anymore.
Yeah.
It impacts the wildlife.
Absolutely.
And then you got the problem. You got to recycle those panels.
Yeah.
I mean, we live in California. Our state basically forced us to put solar panels on the roof by jacking up the price of electricity.
Right.
So we got solar panels on our roof. But I know in about 18 years, they're going to be replaced. And I don't think anybody's thought through the recycling of those millions and millions of solar panels.
Yeah.
What are you going to do with that?
Exactly.
Or the fact that windmills kill birds.
Exactly.
Yeah. So unintended consequences.
Exactly. That's a real theme in looking at some of these so-called solutions. So,
do you have any other ideas you'd like to share with us?
Well, I think one of the things, and we've touched on this already, is just having conversations with people and raising awareness. And, again, like we're doing right now, just talking about our personal responsibility, the fact that Earth is rare, as far as we know, certainly in our solar system and probably far beyond, and it's a gift, and we need to
You're
take care of it.
You're suggesting we should take care of the Earth because there's nowhere else to go?
Exactly. I mean, these ideas about, terraforming Mars or even colonizing Mars or the moon and whatnot, again, the planetary considerations are not...
Well, I read an article where they said we can terraform Mars for only $100 quadrillion.
And even at that, I would dispute it just because of the fact that the gravity's not right.
Well, they do say that they could make it habitable for 50 years, but after the 50 years, you got to spend another $100 quadrillion. So I think we got a sustainability problem.
There's a real sustainability issue. And, you know, so again, our responsibility to take good care of the earth for the fact that God created it and called it good, as well as to provide for future generations and loving our neighbors. But I think we need to have those conversations more regularly, and even about possible solutions, talking about what does it mean to have that responsibility? What should I be doing? I mean, I remember in one of my classes at one point, you know, talking about environmental stewardship and some of the issues that we're facing. And one of the students wrote in a reflection paper, it's not about what difference can I make? I'm only one person. You shouldn't be asking that question. Instead, you should be asking, what is my moral responsibility? What ought I to be doing? And so even if as one person you don't feel like you can make a big difference, if all of us take that responsibility on and ask the question, what ought I to do, then together we can make a big difference.
And if you can give people an economic incentive, all these suggestions I've been making is that people have more money in their pockets if they do this.
Exactly.
And people are selfish. They're going to do what's going to help them.
Exactly.
So if we can give them an economic incentive, I think we can actually solve these problems fast enough. I mean, next month I'm going to be involved in a debate with climate change experts, and the people I'll be debating are what I would call alarmists.
Okay.
They're basically saying, hey, you know, this is a real crisis. And my message is, it's a bigger crisis than what you realize. This really is a huge crisis. But trying to terrify people to accepting tax penalties and reducing their economic well-being, that's going to be a hard sell.
Mm-hmm.
If we give them a strong enough economic incentive, they'll do it right away.
Yeah.
And we need to do it right away.
You're right.
This really is a problem. We need immediate action.
Yeah.
But you're not going to get immediate action if you can't give people an economic incentive.
You're absolutely right. And that's why capitalism works, is because people are at their basic common denominator selfish.
Well, there's another biblical principle. I mean, you talked about what Genesis was saying,
mm-hmm.
how we're stewards of planet Earth to manage it for our benefit and the benefit of all their life.
Yes.
That implies that God has solutions for us that are going to be win-win.
Yeah.
We won't have to choose between what's good for us
and
what's good for the rest of our life.
Yeah.
That statement in the Bible tells us if you look hard enough, you will find win-win solutions.
Right. That's a really good point.
So let's look for them.
Exactly. Couldn't agree with you more.
And we just talked about a few. I'm sure there's many more we could look at.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. But yes, I think it's very, very important for us to have these conversations with people, to raise awareness and to educate people as to not only what the problems are, but what some of the solutions are.
Well, you're on the front lines of being a professor in science at Biola University, and God's given you a lot of platforms. So we're all encouraged by what you do. We'll be praying for you.
Thank you.
That you'll get the message out.
Thank you.
All right.
Praying for you as well.
Thank you. Well, thank you for joining us today on Stars, Cells, and God. Join the discussion in the comments below. Remember to like this video and to subscribe for more content. New episodes of Stars, Cells, and God release each Thursday and are available here on YouTube and on your favorite podcast app. Be sure to share this video with a friend, and remember, the more we know about science, the more reasons we have to believe in Jesus Christ as Creator, Lord, and Savior.
Okay. Sorry, everybody. So we don't have any climate experts here. So we thought maybe we would just do like a little, I don't know, discussion group for a few minutes, if you'd like to. if you want to, get your opinion on a couple questions. So what did you think? That's a pretty good video, right? You like that one? So what do you think is our responsibility to God in regards to the care of the planet, especially concerning climate change? Anybody want to take a minute and say anything about that?
Repeat the question.
What do you think is our responsibility to God in regards to the care of the planet, and especially concerning climate change? Maybe even in the midst of this political milieu that we're at.
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment on that. Basically, you know, early on, the guest, Leslie Wickman, is that what her name was, I think? She provided us all these scriptures. And I guess what that brought to my mind is where have all these scriptures been for these? I mean, I was in high school in the 1950s. Nobody was looking at these scriptures in 1950. And now we see these scriptures now. What this reminds me of, tells me of, is where's the church been? The church has been so behind the times in so many areas. It's behind the times in civil rights. It hasn't led us there. These scriptures are familiar to me, but nobody's ever talking about them. And now we're 70 years later, and now we're bringing the scriptures out. I mean, so that's an issue to me, a commentary on the church, on what we are doing, what we have done, what we should have been doing. I mean, it's like we put our head in the sand and say, oh, yeah, we had this guide that has been available to us for centuries, and now finally, now we realize that these instructions are there. Okay, so that was the first thing that struck me, is that how we have been so out of it in really addressing the needs of our society. The other thing to go on is that all these suggestions that Hugh came out with, you know, beautiful. And so basically, to me, the suggestions that he was making really need to be written down. I don't know if he has plans for that. I mean, there are so many good suggestions there. They need to be written down, and that can be a contribution of what we as Christians, what Hugh was saying, a contribution of a direction that we can provide. So if he were here, I would say, Hugh, you need to have a book about this. Putting these suggestions together and the as a guideline. So anyway, that's what it is.
Thank you for that input. That was really good, points you made. Anybody else on that question? Ted, you look like you wanted to say something.
I walked in at the nuclear
reactor. Oh, okay.
I would say one thing about
the nuclear
reactor.
So, I'm pleased to see Hugh advocating the thorium reactor. I see it among other nuclear reactor technologies discussed in mechanical engineering magazines. I'm a mechanical engineer. And so there is work going on in this regard. It's interesting then when somebody hears about these alternative technologies, you don't hear much about the downside. Why isn't it being adopted? Yes, we know that there's a perception, well, it's true, that conventional, traditional nuclear reactors have the waste problem, and it's a very unpopular political thing, and it appears there's no solution to that. But he says that the thorium reactors don't have that problem. So what problem remains, you know? Is it just political will to get over all the nervous old ladies that don't want a thorium reactor? I mean, if that's all it is, we need some better politicians. But I suspect there may be some other issues, and I'd like to hear a more comprehensive discussion about that. As far as, you know, the environment and people, yeah, we did miss the boat. The church did miss the boat on that and other, you know, civil rights issues, things like that. Although, remember, it's only been the past 100 years that we had any ability to influence the environment on a global scale. Prior to that, there were localized things like, you know, the Thames River in Britain. That was filthy. It was deadly. They cleaned it up because it was killing people, right? And so there are these incentives locally. You know, we cleaned up Acid Rain, right? That was without the church's help. Well, the church is behind the curve on a lot of these things. And it is important that we are good stewards of our environment.
Now, do you think maybe we're behind the curve, possibly because we've focused so much on Darwinism and saying, no, this isn't it. We can't even be in this boat. I don't know. I'm just wondering. Anybody think about that? It's a dumb question. Okay, I got another dumb question then. All right, in Hugh's book, Weathering Climate Change, he says there are three possible options. I think we're talking about most of this already. Mitigation, which is lowering the emissions and all that stuff. Adaptation or defeat. What do you think about that? Obviously, defeat is not an option. Which one do you think is best to do? Because I've tried to consider what adaptation. Has everybody moved out to the equator somehow? Or, you know, or we have some scientific things that we can do to... Anyway, so it's I guess it's mixed with mitigation. So what do you think is the best one, mitigation, adaptation, or do we just have to choose one or all three? Not all three, but two of them.
What problem are you talking about?
Three possible options in the light of climate change, he said. So mitigation and adaptation, and then the third, which is not...
One of the more interesting ideas that he had for me, and I've heard him express this before, is the replanting of the Sahara. That is a real, I don't know what class you put that in, but you know, that's to convert a problem into a plus. So that certainly that is that's one thing that could be a plus. And as far as the other thing is that is the use of natural gas as a transition from coal to a more sustainable energy source. I mean, you go to natural gas and you immediately, as we've discussed recently in our group, the fact that the excess water that's produced off with natural gas is actually self-controlled because the water that's produced is self-limiting because it's condensable. It reaches a point where the water will no longer accumulate to a greater effect. This is what Hugh was pointing out in part of what he's talking about. And so that natural gas then, that if you can convince people to do that, that's a great transition. And then he talks about that, and as Ted was mentioning a little bit more, you know, then the transition is going to the thorium reactors, and now that's the I used to have something to do with the nuclear power, with uranium reactors, and so I'm familiar with a lot of those problems, but I guess it's my fault that I knew nothing about the thorium reactors. But that really sounds like it attacks a fundamental problem of the uranium reactors, and the fact that so many of your reactors in the U.S. have been closed because of their threats of elimination of the waste. You eliminate that waste, which he was talking about. That's really a great, and I don't know why I'm so unfamiliar with that particular technology, but I'm not.
Anyway. Second, excuse me.
Hello, nice to meet you all. I'm the newbie in the room, so I'm being very, very brave here. This is my first time here. I just have a comment on, I got really excited when he talked about replanting the Sahara, but I'm originally from Haiti, and Haiti has a deforestation problem as well. One thing, because they tried that same type of project in Haiti where they provided kerosene cookware, if you would, kerosene-fueled cookware for Haitians. And one of the problems that they encountered is that Haitians basically said the food doesn't taste the same. So I'm actually, as I was listening to that, I'm like, I wonder if there's a way of contacting Hugh to just send him a note to say, you know, I love the idea. I would actually love to learn more about it and get involved in efforts of reforesting various areas. But those are the little details that sometimes get in the way because, I mean, they just love their food a certain way and the charcoal gives it a certain flavor. So it's things like that that typically get in the way of our progress, you know? So, and I just, you know, I think it's a call for us to just be really, really more astute and adopt a researcher type of mentality to just really dig through the details and help come up with the solutions to some of these problems we're facing.
Thank you, thank you. Yeah, we got to keep the human factor there, right? So.
You know, I think we are worrying about things less important than what's happening in this world right now. We are being faced with a nuclear annihilation from Russia, from Turkey, from Islamic country, and we are worrying about the fuel resources. I think we better fix our political system first to get rid of the threat we are facing than to worry about, you know, energy sources, which we can deal with it later.
Thank you. Interesting point. I wonder if maybe we can do both and possibly. I don't know.
I would agree with that, in the sense that these problems are presenting us at the same time. And we're not going to solve one without the other, without solving the other. Because, I mean, to solve the energy problem, the climate problem, requires people to be willing to sacrifice in certain areas, requires leadership, so that to let people know what has to be done. And like Hugh was saying, is that the way you lead people is not to confront them that they're going to have to face an economic, you know, great disadvantage, but to be able to put solutions out there in ways where they don't have to do that. But I think our problem now is the unwillingness, basically, of leadership in the country is not willing to address real problems as opposed to being more concerned about political advantage. And unless we get leadership that's really willing to put all of our welfare ahead of their own welfare, and we've had those great leaders in the past. We have. That's why our country has been as good as it has been. So we've had those leaders. We haven't had them recently. We don't have them now. And I'm agreeing with you. Yes, but the problems are together. We have to address both that political working together, and at the same time, being as part of that working together, being able to look at these possible solutions and work them out.
And. On YouTube, if you guys get a chance, check out this guy. His name is Alan Savory, and he's the founder of Africa Center for Holistic Management. And what he grew up in Africa. He was in charge of a big reserve, and they were things were dying off, animals were dying off. He thought it was the elephants that were affecting the environment there, digging up the ground and stuff. And what the elephants were destroying the crops and doing stuff and ruining the ground. And he loves animals, and he they exterminated like 78 elephants, and the problem got worse. And he loves elephants, and so he made it a lifelong goal to try to fix the environment and fix the problem. And so he, what he discovered after a lot of lifetime of experimenting, is if they could take the herds, and they could, and if they could, everybody had little farms and everybody had their little animals around, but he found if you could take a whole village full of animals and combine them together, and then put them in an area of the ground where they would eat, and then they would also fertilize the ground. And then if you managed that, if you moved it every couple of weeks to a different area, it would restore the land. And he went to the worst deserts and the worst places he could find, and he did that, and it brought the land back. And there's even ponds and things growing and plants and trees. And he can do this anywhere in the world. He has a new center he opened up in Colorado to train people, to train leaders on how to do this. But it's all about just getting animals in big herds again, and then managing the herd and moving them so they don't, so they're long enough to fertilize the land, but not to destroy it. And so if you look him up, Alan Savory, on the internet, it's fascinating. Shows have been about him and what he's doing to fight desertification of the world, and to fight the climate and stuff, the global warming. And it's really amazing. So I think we're pretty much done. It's 1:42, and so we're wrapping things up. And thank you for coming today. And that was really fascinating with Leslie Wickman. That was a great interview. And so, all righty, we'll have a great Sunday and the rest of the week, and we'll see you next week.